Sometimes when I'm playing, the guitar strap will bother my neck until it feels like a Charlie horse and the muscles start spasming from the bottom of my spine to midway up my back. When that happens, I can't even turn my head to acknowledge a fan for the rest of the show. It's so fucked up. People think that I'm shy or strange or mean because they see me like that on stage. They think that I've purposely cultivated an image of distance and aloofness. But the truth is that I'm a prisoner in my own body. Eventually, during the Girls, Girls, Girls tour, I became so frustrated and weary of the pain that chronic depression set in. Psychologists gave me antidepressants and pain management counselors fed me anesthetics, but nothing worked. So I decided to try my own medicine, alcohol. Nikki was strung out on heroin again. Tommy was unconscious for half the tour, and Vince was drinking himself into a stupor, and everybody knew it. Me? I preferred to keep my problems a secret. But the problem with secrets is that nobody can help you if nobody knows what's wrong. And a lot was wrong on that tour.
Chapter 3. Tommy. A complete itinerary of the quotidian perambulations of our heroes on their ensuing journey, outlined in full and excruciating detail. We had a huge-ass jet. We had endless cash, and we could do whatever the fuck we wanted. Girls, Girls, Girls was the raddest time I ever had in my life, or at least I think it was, because nothing stands out but a blur of fucking insanity. We partied like clockwork, bro. You could check the clock in whatever time zone we were in and figure out exactly what kind of shit we were into. For a while, we even had this drug kingpin following the tour bus in an exotic Excalibur with a license plate that said dealer. Whenever we got out of the bus, he would suddenly appear with his diamond-packed Rolex, gold chains, and a token couple of bitches on each arm, throwing bindles of coke to everyone in the band and crew. He was the pimpest fucking drug dealer ever, and he always had his party hat on. But the record company flipped out and told us he had to go because he was a magnet for cops and trouble. We were sorry to see him leave, but fucking dealers and pimps and partied-out freaks were a dime a dozen on that tour. Every day was a battle between a band bent on destruction and a record company determined to keep us in check. And we may have won the battle, but we lost the war. It was the last tour of its kind for us, and to paraphrase Stephen Wright, it didn't go something like this. It went exactly like this. 1700 to 1830. Phone rings. Wake up. Remember nothing. Answer phone. Struggle through interview with radio disc jockey or newspaper reporter. If alone in bed, fine. If not alone in bed, that's fine too. If necessary to puke during interview, cover receiver with hand and puke on floor. If there are people passed out on the floor, try not to get any on them. If interview is longer than 15 minutes, roll over and piss off the edge of the bed closest to the corner of the room. Continue interview. During second interview, open door for room service, ordered by road manager. Eat unless too sick to eat. Throw up again. Finish interview. 1830 to 1845. Baggage call. Knock on door. Bellboy retrieves suitcases, which have not been opened since bellboy last dropped them off in room. Put on clothes from previous night. Spend 10 minutes searching for sunglasses. 1845 to 1900. Wander out of room. Find lobby. See band. Say, hey dude, how about last night?
That was fucking fun.
Yeah. Find van or limo transportation to gig. 1900 to 2000. Arrive at venue, sound check, nurse hangover backstage, submit dinner order, get massaged to remove some toxins from system, drink, listen to music, hang out, come back to life, meet record and radio creeps, listen to them ask,
don't you remember pissing on that cop car?
Answer honestly, no. 2000 to 2100, opening act performs. Find wardrobe case, peel off street clothes, black leather pants and black t-shirt, change into stage clothes, black leather pants and black t-shirt. Make fun of Vince for being the only one in band to shower. Sit on drum stool in front of mirror and open up cosmetics box. Smear on eyeliner, rouge, and makeup. Consider shaving. 2100 to 2115. Drink or snort cocaine with opening act when they come off stage. 2115 to 2120. Production manager gives 5-minute call. Lift weights backstage to get pumped up and sweat out toxins. Production manager yells, "Showtime!" 2120 to 2200. Try to get into the groove on stage. Play All in the Name of, Live Wire, and Dancing on Glass. 2200 to 2300. Blood begins to flow. Adrenaline kicks in. Play Looks That Kill, 10 Seconds to Love, Red Hot, Home Sweet Home, and Wild Side, and play them well. Split fifth of whiskey with Nikki during bass and drum solo. Backstage, Vince washes sleeping pill down with beer. Mick drinks glass full of straight vodka and smiles because he thinks he has rest of band fooled into believing it's plain water. 2300 to 2315. Finish show with Helter Skelter and Girls, Girls, Girls. Walk off stage comatose and hyperventilating. Grab oxygen mask. Stare at untouched dinner. 2315 to 2345. Wait for someone to ask, "Anybody got a line?" Cut up drugs. Snort drugs. Change from sweaty stage leathers back into sweaty street leathers. Find hospitality room. Meet fans. Watch rest band hunt for human entertainment. Consider partaking. Go to production office. Call Heather. 2345 to 2400. Ask management for permission to stay in city. Beg management for permission to stay in city. Accuse them of purposely making band travel to next town during the only hours when bars and strip clubs are open. Attempt to punch them when they confirm accusation. Get in van or limo for airport. 2400 to 0300. Arrive at airport. Wait for Vince to finish with girl in airport bathroom. Meet drug dealers on tarmac. Board Gulfstream 1 plane with black leather interior. Find designated seat. Make sure a stewardess has laid out correct drugs and drinks on each meal tray ahead of time. For Nikki, white wine and zombie dust. For Vince, sleeping pill. For Mick, vodka. For me, cocktail and zombie dust. 0300 to 0400. Arrive in new city. If city laws allow establishments to serve alcohol until 4 a.m., ask local record company representative distance to nearest strip club. Groan when he says 45 minutes. Ask if record company planned it that way. Threaten violence when he confirms accusation. Tell limo driver to take band there anyway. 0400 to 0900. Arrive at hotel. Look for drugs and alcohol in lobby. If none, tell road manager to bring drugs and alcohol to room. Drink. Do drugs. Go on rampage in room, on roof, or in parking lot. Get caught. Get locked in room or handcuffed to bed by road manager. Yell. Scream. Threaten jobs. Shoot up heroin alone. 0900 to 1700. Pass out. 1700 to 1830. Phone rings. Wake up. Remember nothing. Repeat cycle. Zombie dust. Mix of halcyon, a nervous system sedative, and cocaine, a nervous system stimulant. Crushed and stored in vial. When consumed, keeps body awake, but shuts brain off. If Heather was visiting, which was rare because of her busy schedule, the hotel ritual was slightly different. In that case, the scenario went exactly like this. Meet Heather in lobby. Fuck. Cuddle. Talk. Ignore knocking on door. Listen to Nikki yell, "Tommy, I've got an eight ball," through door. Ignore him. Listen to Nikki yell, "Just because she's here doesn't mean we can't hang out." Continue to ignore him. After 10 more minutes of knocking and yelling, exasperatedly open door. Listen to Heather complain, "I'm only out here for one day. Why do we have to spend it with him?" Get in fight. Get pissed at Heather. Get pissed at Nikki. Get pissed at self.
Chapter 4. Mick. As his musical compatriots descend from decadence to addiction, Mick finds himself unable to resist joining them on this unfortunate exploit. One of my favorite movies is Crossroads, about the legend that Robert Johnson sold his soul to the devil at a Mississippi crossroads one night so that he could play guitar like no man has since. At the end, the devil comes to Robert Johnson in the depths of his unhappiness and gloats, "You got what you wanted. You wanted to be a blues man." I used to tell myself the same thing. You got what you wanted. You wanted to be a rock and roll star. Deal with it. My dreams had come true, but they weren't what I had thought they would be. When we were recording Girls, Tom Zutaut would stop by the studio and see me drunk, slouched over, and knocked out on painkillers. When he first signed us, he used to call me the Purple People Eater because he said I had a purple aura. But now he looked at me distraught. "Your purple people eater is fading," he said sadly. "It's fading into this weird alcoholic thing." "No, it's not," I would mumble back. But it was. When I was recording the staccato guitar line at the end of the song Girls, 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 I fell out of the chair because I was so drunk. Though we used the take anyway because we liked how it sounded and I was in too much pain to play anymore. We had sold millions of records and I was still broke. The rest of the guys were partying and spending all this money on drugs, but I was stuck with lawyers, accountants, and greedy exes coming down on me for child support. When I left for the tour, I kept my car at a friend's house, and not only did he total the right side, but he had the nerve to ask for $500 for car sitting. When you start to get successful, everybody thinks you're rich. Me? I didn't even have enough money to buy another car. And on top of that, I lost the last guy who I had considered to be a real friend. I haven't had one since. Before I went on stage, I'd line up 6 shots of vodka next to an open can of Coke and then down them all. During the show, I'd have a glass of pure vodka on the side, which the other guys thought was water. Afterward, I'd bring out a jar of Marzade, a mix of tequila, orange juice, and grenadine, and suck that down. Alcohol would bring out sides of my personality that I never even knew existed. I was moldy one night at the Lexington Queen in Japan, and the owner happened to have a Godzilla mask. I put it on, hopped on the dance floor, and started doing what we call crack dancing, shaking my ass with my butt crack hanging out of my pants. We used to do a lot of crack bowling, too. I suddenly got inspired to leave the bar with the Godzilla mask on and terrorize unsuspecting Japanese civilians, maybe crush some office buildings, too. I pulled my pants down to my ankles and walked up and down the street barking and snapping at people with my Godzilla mask on. The rest of the guys were chasing after me laughing because they'd never seen me behave like that before. Someone had told me that it's legal in Japan for a man to stop anywhere and pee on the side of the road, so I decided to see if that was true. I thought I was so funny. But when I returned to my hotel room, I looked at myself in the mirror and just saw an ugly, dirty guy with a big, giant belly. Since I had started drinking heavily after Vince's accident, I had slowly been blowing up like a balloon. I was surprised no one pitchforked me and stuck an apple in my mouth. I was such a pig. That's why I should have been suspicious when Emmy Cannon, one of the 2 backup singers we had hired, in emulation of the Rolling Stones with Mary Clayton or Humble Pie with Madeline Bell and Doris Troy, started getting really friendly with me. She was thin, athletic, and beautiful, and I was old, ugly, and sickly. No woman in her right mind would have been attracted to me. The guys had made a rule. You don't shit in your backyard, as Nikki explained it, and you don't sleep with anybody who works with you. So when they started hearing Emmy's voice coming from my room at all hours, they flipped out. The Jack Daniels and Halcyon made them blind with rage, and they punished us much more than we deserved. They stopped talking to us, gave us dirty looks, poured drinks on us, and smeared food all over our luggage. Emmy was very religious, and they showed her no mercy. Whenever the plane hit turbulence during the tour, they'd stand up, drop their pants to their ankles and start chanting, "Fuck God, let's crash," just to make her freak out, grab her crucifix necklace, and start crossing herself and praying. If I tried to stop them, they'd heave a bottle of Jack at me. It was so hypocritical because before we had hired Emmy and Donna McDaniel, the other backup singer in the Nasty Habits, we were working with a vocalist named Bree Howard. She had a dirty, bluesy voice like Tina Turner and had sung with Robbie Neville and toured with Jimmy Buffett. But just as she was about to join the band, Nikki started dating her. I was disillusioned and disgusted that Nikki and the guys came down so hard on me after that. I guess they lost all the faith and trust they had in me, and I definitely lost any faith and trust I had in them as friends and bandmates. If I didn't love playing guitar so much, I would have walked out on them. I've always been ready to crawl back to where I came from. Most people aren't. They think bad things only happen to other people. That's why I try to rely only on myself. Anything could happen to our society, and probably will, from a massive earthquake to a nuclear attack to a stock market crash. Most people say, "Oh, I have a great job, plenty of money, good benefits, and medical coverage. I feel great and safe." But what if a depression or a food shortage raised the price of bread to $50? How would you feed your family? Could you survive as your ancestors did? Unlikely. When you're running around begging for scraps of food, drugs, and girls suddenly don't seem so important. I never really got into the decadence or the pampering or the hard drugs like the rest of the band did. They used to call me 8-Ball Mars because I'd say, "Give me an 8-Ball and don't ask me why." I was new to cocaine, and when it became a problem, I stopped. Not like Nikki. I was mad as hell when I first saw him doing heroin. We were playing at the Long Beach Arena on the Shout at the Devil tour, and he was sniffing a little bindle. I asked, "What the fuck was that?" He said it was smack, and I asked, "Have you started shooting that shit?" He said that he would never do that, but I was fucking livid. I knew exactly what was going to happen to him, and during the girls' tour, it did. But how can you save someone like that from himself? No one could stop me from drinking and swelling up. No one could stop Elvis from the pills that killed him. That's what I thought when I got the call between legs of the tour telling me what I already feared. Our tour manager was shit-faced, high, and crying when he broke the news to me. He asked me to call England and cancel the European leg of the tour for him. Why me? I was hungover, confused, upset, and mad, at Nikki and at myself for not doing more to stop him. I called Kerrang! Magazine and said the first thing that came to my head. "We can't come over because we heard you have severe storms over there, and, we have so much equipment that we are afraid that it could cause a cave-in, because, there is snow on the roof or something." I didn't know what I was talking about. All I knew was that I couldn't tell them what Rich had really told me. Nikki was dead.
Chapter 5. Nikki. How fate came to Nikki in the form of a Japanese businessman, an ancient soothsayer, an accommodating drug dealer, a pair of female fans, and 800 prostitutes. Early in the girls' tour, I stopped dating Vanity. Whenever she came out to meet us, she'd annoy me, the rest of the band, and the road crew by riding a bicycle around the stage in the middle of rehearsal or doing something else obnoxious. It wasn't much of a relationship anyway, and the drugs had caused her to lose a kidney. She was even starting to lose her sight and hearing. I found out years later, though, that she turned herself around. She cleaned up, found God, became a reverend, and changed her name back to the one her mother gave her, Denise Williams. Now I was truly alone. I had no girlfriend, my grandmother was dead, my dad was probably dead, and I didn't talk to my mom. So I was the only one in the band without a family, a girlfriend, a wife, or any prospects, and I was too smacked out to care. As for the music, I could hardly even stand the last two albums I had written. And the acclaim? There was none. Critics despised us. I felt like the McDonald's of rock and roll. My life was disposable. Consume me and throw me out. After 6 months of touring girls, my existence had disintegrated to the point where every waking moment was about drugs. I went on stage to get drugs. I came off stage to find more drugs. I used my per diem to buy drugs, and I traveled to each city only to see if anyone had new drugs. Heroin, coke, freebase, jack, zombie dust. They all had been controlling my life for a year straight. And like a bad relationship, the longer they stayed in my life, the more miserable and out of control my life became. Soon everyone knew what was going on. One night after a show, we returned to our jet to find a note from Steven Tyler and Joe Perry of Aerosmith on the windshield, telling us we were crashing and burning, and that they had been there and could help us. Though once we had idolized them, now we just laughed at them, ignored their warning, and kept crashing and burning. Just before we left for Japan, an earthquake hit Los Angeles. I had been up for 3 days straight, and when I ran out of the house, the only thing I grabbed was my freebase pipe. That's how important it was to me. I didn't even take my house keys, and had to break open my side door to get back inside. I knew I was in a downward spiral, but I didn't realize how low I had actually spun until we started our second tour of polite, civilized Japan, where our antics made us stick out like clowns at a funeral. Coming into Tokyo on a high-speed bullet train from Osaka, Tommy and I turned into our super-powered alter egos, the Terror Twins. Powered by magical zombie dust, we were more powerful than a speeding bullet train, able to inhale large lines in a single snort, and blessed with X-ray powers that enabled us to find and consume every bottle of sake on the train. We ran up and down the aisle saving the world by spilling rice and powdered donuts on our arch rivals. That copulating pair of supervillains, Emmy and Mick, or, as we preferred to call them, Jonah and the Whale. "We should have killed you all in the war," Tommy suddenly bellowed, and we both started grabbing sake bottles and giving select passengers a purifying bath. Tommy was in his Indiana Jones hugging a dominatrix phase of dressing, and as he ran down the aisle, no one could see his flesh. Just a low-slung hat, skin-tight gloves, and a coat trailing behind him like the cape of some avenging angel cut out of denim, leather, and cocaine. Our Japanese promoter, Mr. Udo, was terrified. "You must settle down," he told us sternly. "Fuck you," I yelled, and I grabbed a Jack bottle and threw it at him. The missile didn't even come close to its intended target. Instead, it hit a terrified commuter who collapsed to the ground with blood pouring out of his head. Mr. Udo didn't bat an eyelash. "I want to do something for you," he said calmly, "but you have to sit down first." I returned to my seat and he pushed his thumb into the back of my neck. A rush of some kind of fluid or blood ran through my body and I slumped in my seat, completely mellow. My superpowers were gone. Mr. Udo then walked over to Tommy and did the same thing. Sitting there, we realized that we hadn't been funny at all. We had really upset everyone, especially Mick, who looked like he was ready to walk out on us any minute. It was nearly the end of the tour, and everybody was sick of the show. Not the concert, but the show, which was me and Tommy, the Terror Twins, a pair so stupid we never managed to amuse anybody but ourselves. When we got off the train in Tokyo, there were thousands of fans waiting for us. I walked out to greet them, but a squad of cops materialized and walked toward me. "Nikki-san," Mr. Udo said, "you are going to have to go to jail. You understand, don't you?" "Fuck you!" "No, Nikki-san, this is serious. You have to go to jail." Doc McGee tried to intercede. "I'm his manager," he told the cops, and they threw him to the ground and handcuffed him. Then they marched toward me and in front of all the fans knocked me off my feet, handcuffed me, and led me into a squad car. Tommy chased after, harassing the cops and yelling, "Take me too! If he's going to jail, I'm fucking going too!" "No, no, no!" Doc barked, trying to sound like he was in control as he sat handcuffed in the back seat of the squad car. "Take it easy. We'll have him out in an hour." After a few hours, they brought Doc and me to the sergeant's desk at the station. I was wearing leather pants, high heels, a torn T-shirt, and makeup. I was sweaty and still completely high. It was after midnight and dark in the station house, so I took off my sunglasses. "I'd leave those glasses on," Doc said. Your eyes are blood red, and there's makeup running all over your face. I put my sunglasses back on and kicked my feet up on the sergeant's desk. I didn't give a fuck what happened to me. The sergeant walked in and said something in Japanese. An interpreter, who Mr. Udo had sent over, translated. He said to please remove your feet from the desk. "Hey, can I ask you a question?" I snapped at the sergeant. The translator spoke to the sergeant and then told me I could ask whatever I wanted. "Okay," I said. "If my balls were on your chin, where do you think my dick would be?" The sergeant looked at the translator expectantly. The translator sighed and began speaking in Japanese.
"Arigato gozaimasu,"
the sergeant said. "Thank you very much." "Sure," I nodded. The two spoke some more, then the translator grabbed my arm and escorted me out of the station. "What the fuck just happened?" I asked him on the way back to the hotel. I told him that you said the bottle accidentally slipped out of your hand and broke, and that you feel really bad about the misunderstanding because you love Japan and the Japanese people and are looking forward to going home and telling the American press how hospitable the Japanese are. "So you didn't say anything about my balls?" "No." "Then you're not a very good translator, are you?" The next night, it was Vince's turn to disgrace us. He had polished off a pitcher of kamikazes at a Roppongi restaurant and was so wasted that he wouldn't stop talking. The only problem was that nobody understood a word he was saying. At the table next to us, there were four Yakuza gangsters in suits. Vince suddenly jumped up and slurred, "That's it!" He walked over to the Yakuza table, grabbed the underside with his hands, and flipped it over on them. The Yakuza guys dropped to the floor, pulled guns out of their waistbands, and raised the barrels over the edge of the table so that they were pointing directly at Vince. Fred Saunders, our bodyguard and wet nurse, jumped on Vince like he was a grenade about to explode and escorted him out of the restaurant. "What the fuck did you do that for?" Fred asked Vince.
"Those guys was talking shit about me," Vince slurred.
"What do you mean they were talking shit about you? They were speaking Japanese."
"Japanese?"
Vince looked at Fred, uncomprehending. "Yeah, we're in Japan." "Oh." Vince knitted his brow and suddenly grew quiet. I don't think he even knew where he was, and he was still supposed to be on probation. Later that night, we went to the Lexington Queen, where even Quiet Mick was out of control, running around with his pants around his knees and a Godzilla mask on his face, stomping on glasses and trying to breathe fire out of his ass. Vince went back to the hotel with some Yakuza guy's girlfriend, and I stuck around starting fist fights. The first one with Tommy. To this day, he insists I hit him in the mouth, though he was so drunk he fell over before I had the chance to connect. And the last one with an American tourist whose head ended up cracked against a steel pole. The next morning, I woke up and suddenly realized I had been so busy fighting and getting out of jail the previous day that I had completely forgotten to celebrate my birthday. Vince woke up the next morning naked on the floor of his hotel room with his prized Rolex watch gone. Yakuza's revenge. After three shows at Budokan, we were all supposed to go home for Christmas before our European tour. Tommy couldn't wait for his first Christmas in his multi-million-dollar mansion with Heather. Mick and Emmy were psyched to finally begin a normal relationship back home. Vince kept talking about banging Charisse, a mud wrestler from the Tropicana he had started dating. And me? I had no one. No chick, no family, and no friends besides drug dealers. So what was the point in going home and spending Christmas Day doing drugs by myself? I announced to everyone that I was embarking on a solo tour. Not a music tour, but a tour of drugs and prostitutes. I was going to go to Hong Kong, Malaysia, Beijing, and then end with a fucking bang in Bangkok. I told Doc to send my suitcase back to Los Angeles. All I needed was a pair of black leather pants, a t-shirt, and my wallet. If I felt like changing clothes, I could just buy them, wear them, and then throw them in the garbage and be done with them. Fuck it. I didn't need anything. "There's no way you're going to do that," said Doc. "Fucking watch me," I spit at him. "And if you stand in my way, you're fucking fired." We argued back and forth for half an hour until we were at each other's throats. Finally, Mr. Udo stepped in. "I will go with you," he said. "What?" Doc and I both looked at him incredulous.
We go together on your tour.
Okay. Doc threw up his pudgy little hands. I'll go too. Then he stormed out of the room, mumbling something about not even getting Christmas off. The next day, the three of us boarded a plane to Hong Kong. I was so dirty that no one would sit in my row. Finally, Mr. Udo, wearing a business suit, took the seat next to me.
Nikki-san, I must talk to you, he said gently in my ear. Last time my friend was like this, he died.
I'm sorry to hear that, I told him, not really caring.
My friend was Tommy Bolin.
Really?
I suddenly grew interested.
You are a lot like Tommy-san, he continued. You hold a lot of pain from your past, and when you hold your pain inside like that, sometimes it hurts you, and it makes you hurt yourself. I can see that you are very creative, like Tommy-san, but you are killing your creativity.
I spent a lot of time with Tommy-san, and I told him that I was his friend and that he needed to quit. He told me he could not quit. He died before the year was over. So I am telling you now that you need to quit. You are going to die. I am your friend. You are like Tommy, and I don't want to lose you, too.
Ah, Mr. Udo, I said. I'm just having fun, he frowned. I could tell that, although I had caused him nothing but grief, this very professional Japanese businessman had somehow taken a liking to me and was determined to save me from the grave I was hell-bent on running into. He saw that grave lying open somewhere in the earth directly ahead of me, and he knew I was heading straight for it. Only the road was dark, and nobody but my maker knew when the earth would suddenly disappear beneath my feet, and I'd drop into it so fast that I wouldn't even have time to regret choosing such a dangerous path without a single light to guide me. That night in Hong Kong, I left the hotel by myself and went to a strip club that the desk clerk at the hotel told me was really a whorehouse. Inside, there were four different rooms. One had a Chinese band playing top 40 American songs, another had booths full of Chinese triad gangsters, and another had dancers on stage. I took a seat in the fourth room where women were parading across the floor, numbered 1 to 800. There was every kind of Asian chick for every kind of fetish you could imagine, from petite nymphettes and baby bonnets sucking lollipops to strapping women in leather S&M outfits. I motioned for the hostess and ordered them like food dishes. I'll take number 14, number 7, and number 8. Send those to my room. Then I ordered 10 for Doc and a dozen for Mr. Udo. I really thought that I was doing them a favor and repaying their kindness for chaperoning me on my solo tour. I paid for the girls, went back to my room, and passed out. If anyone knocked on my door that night, I didn't hear it. Or maybe I did hear it, let them in, and got spanked by a fat Korean. I can't really remember, but sex was the last thing on my mind. When I woke up the next afternoon, I threw up, shot up the last of my cocaine stash, put on my leather pants, and met Doc and Mr. Udo in the lobby.
Did you guys get your presents from me? I asked.
Nikki, Doc grimaced. You're sick. I answered the door, and there were two girls in Nazi outfits and a nun. What's wrong with you?
Fuck, Doc. I was just having fun. How about you, Mr. Udo? Did you enjoy your gifts?
My wife is like my heir, he said.
Huh?
Without her, I cannot live. She is my heir.
I stood there feeling like a giant prick. I had tried to contaminate his heir.
You go home now, Mr. Udo said. You don't go to Bangkok. You are done, okay?
Okay, I squeaked.
I had finally found someone willing to be a father figure, and in the space of 24 hours, I had already let him down and disgusted him. I deserved to be abandoned again. Mr. Udo went back to Tokyo that day, and Doc booked a flight for himself to New York and one for me to L.A. for the next morning. That night, I wandered the busy, compact streets of Hong Kong with my translator, looking for drugs. We turned into a long alleyway off Wan Chai Road, and at the end, there was a solitary lantern swaying in the wind. In front of it was a manhole cover sending steam rising into the air. It looked like something out of a horror movie, so of course I told the translator I wanted to walk down the alley. At the end, under the lantern, there was nothing except a little old Chinese man in a brown robe.
Who is he? I asked the translator.
He is the soothsayer.
Oh, cool, I said.
Can he tell my fortune? She talked to him and then asked me to give him $4 Hong Kong and show him my hand. I thrust my hand under his nose. He ran his hand across mine, then suddenly curled my hand up and pushed it away. His face was twisted as if he'd just drunk sour milk. He said something to her, then waved her away. What did he say? I asked the translator.
You don't want to know,
she said, turning away and walking ahead. No, I chased after her. What did he say?
He said that you are going to die before the end of the year if you don't change your ways.
The date was December 21st.
He also said that you are unable to change your ways.
I don't think God could have given me any more warnings than he had in the past few weeks. My life had wound down to a sad, lonely addiction, and everyone, from square businessmen like Mr. Udo to crazy old fortune tellers, could see it coming. Everyone but me. For God's sake, I yelled at the translator, I just wasted $10 on that. When we returned to the hotel, I called my dealer in L.A. to make the usual arrangement. I'm coming in tomorrow, I told him. Meet me with $1,000 worth of smack and some coke, syringes, and a case of crystal. I've got some time off before I have to go to Europe, and I want to make the most of it. I flew into Los Angeles International, got high in the silver limo that picked me up, and went back to the house. Sometimes you can't tell how much you've changed when you've been away until you see yourself in your own mirror. That way, you can compare yourself with how you looked when you last saw yourself in the exact same mirror. I wanted to cry. I was getting a puffy, alcoholic face like Jimmy Page or Mick Mars. My arms were rail thin and covered with long, discolored track marks, and the rest of my body was soft and gushy. My face looked like one of those slippery kids' toys that has a layer of fluid underneath the skin, though the toy I resembled had clearly been owned by some brat who abused the shit out of it. Even my hair was falling out in clumps, and the ends looked split and fried. I was disintegrating. I needed to go out on the scene to escape from my own decay and loneliness. I flipped through my phone book in search of old friends. I called Robin Crosby, then Slash, because Guns N' Roses were going to open for us in America after the European tour. I picked up Robin at his house in the silver limo I liked to rent and gave him some blow. On the way to the Franklin Plaza Hotel, where Guns N' Roses were staying because they were all homeless, I threw up all over the limo. I wiped the chunks off on an antique beaver hair-covered top hat I had bought for Slash and gave it to him at his door, along with a bottle of whiskey. Some of the guys in Megadeth were also staying at the hotel, so we all piled into the limo. Robin scored some junk from his dealer, who wasn't too happy about the conspicuous limo outside his house, and we did drugs until our minds went blank. We drove to the cat house, raised hell, and staggered back to the limo, with hordes of fans tailing us. Back at the Franklin, Robin's dealer was waiting. He said he had gotten some sweet Persian heroin while we were gone and asked if I wanted some. Yeah, I told him. But you do it. By that point in the evening, I was too sloppy, fucked up to get myself off. The only time I had let someone else shoot me up before was in the tenement in Hammersmith, where I was almost thrown out with the trash. He rolled up my sleeve, tied off my arm with a rubber tube, and plunged the Persian into my veins. The heroin raced to my heart, exploded all over my body, and in an instant, I was blue. I lost consciousness. When I opened my eyes, everything was a blur of light, color, and motion. I was on my back, moving through some kind of corridor. Sounds whooshed in and out of my ears, unrecognizable at first, until a voice slowly emerged out of the white noise. "We're losing him. We're losing him," it said. I tried to sit up to figure out what was going on. I thought it would be hard to lift my body, but to my surprise, I shot upright as if I weighed nothing. Then it felt as if something very gentle was grabbing my head and pulling me upward. Above me, everything was bright white. I looked down and realized that I had left my body. Nikki Six, or the filthy, tattooed container that had once held him, was lying covered face to toe with a sheet on a gurney being pushed by medics into an ambulance. The fans who had been following us all night were crowded into the street, craning to see what was going on. And then I saw, parked nearby, the silver limo that had carried us around all night, that had carried me to my... Something not as gentle as the hand on my head, something rough and impatient, grabbed my foot. And in an instant, I shot down through the air, through the roof of the ambulance, and landed with a painful jerk back into my body. I struggled to open my eyes, and I saw adrenaline needles, not one, like in Pulp Fiction, but two. One was sticking out of the left flank of my chest, the other was in the right. "No one's gonna die in my fucking ambulance," I heard a man's voice say. Then I passed out. When I woke up, there was a flashlight shining directly into my eyes. "Where did you get your drugs?" a voice barked. I groaned and tried to clear the fuzz and pain out of my head. "You are a heroin addict." I tried to move my head to avoid the flashlight beam that was burning into my skull. "Where did you get your drugs?" I couldn't see a thing, but I could feel tubes running into my nose and needles taped against my arms. If there was any sensation I could recognize in a delirium, it was a needle in my arm and a cop. "Answer me, you filthy junkie." I opened my mouth and sucked in what felt like the first breath of my entire life. I almost choked on it. I coughed and wondered why I had been given a second chance. I was alive. What could I do to celebrate this precious miracle of a second life? What could I say to show my appreciation? "Fuck you!" "Why, you little junkie scumbag motherfucker," the cop yelled back at me. "Who gave you those drugs?" "Fuck you!" "That's it. If you don't tell us, am I being held on anything?" No. Luckily, I didn't have any drugs on me when I passed out. Robin or someone must have flushed everything left in the room. "Then fuck off!" I passed out again. The next thing I remember, I was standing shirtless in the hospital parking lot. There were two girls sitting on the curb crying. I walked to them and asked, "What's up?" Their faces went white. "You're alive," one of them stammered. "What are you talking about? Of course I'm alive." They wiped their eyes and stared at me speechless. They were real fans. "Say, can you guys give me a ride home?" An excited sweat broke out on their faces, and they nervously led me into the passenger seat of their Mazda.
Chapter 6. Vince. A late-night phone call strikes terror in the hearts of our living protagonists. I rolled over and answered the phone, half asleep. I was the first one to get the call. "Nikki's in the hospital. He OD'd." It was our tour manager, Rich Fisher, on the line. "Jesus, what? Is he dead or alive?" "I'm not sure," Rich said. "Call me back right away and let me know, all right?" I started to dress so I could visit him at the hospital, if he was alive. The phone rang again. It was Boris, the limo driver who always worked for Nikki. He said that he had seen Nikki's drug dealer jump out of a hotel room window and run down the street yelling, "I just killed Nikki Six." Then he saw an ambulance pull up and medics carry Nikki out on a stretcher with a sheet covering his face. I never cry. But that night I did. Tears rolled down my face. And for the first time in as long as I could remember, I didn't think about myself. For all the shit he put me through, I really loved that arrogant son of a bitch. I stared at the phone, not sure who to call or what to do. Then it rang again. Chuck Shapiro was calling. A reporter had woken him up asking for a quote for an obituary for Nikki. So it was true. Panicked but always level-headed, Chuck had me wait on the line while he placed a call to Cedars-Sinai, the hospital the ambulance had brought Nikki to. "I'm calling about Nikki Six," Chuck blurted when the receptionist answered. "He just left," she told him. "He just left? What do you mean? I thought he was dead." "Yeah, he just left. He pulled the tubes out of his nose, tore the IV out of his arms, and told everyone to fuck off. He walked out with only a pair of leather pants on."
Chapter 7. Nikki. In a conclusion sure to tear at the heartstrings of our more anemic readers, Nikki discovers fate, a relentless pursuer, still chasing at his heels, her scythe drawn and ready. On the ride home, the radio stations were reporting my death. The girls looked at me with big, wet eyes and asked with genuine concern, "You're not going to do drugs anymore, are you, Nikki?" I had felt so alone and monstrous on tour, as if I had nobody that cared for me and nobody to care for. In that car, I realized that I was one of the luckiest guys in the world. I had millions of people who cared for me and millions of people I cared for. No way, I told them from the bottom of my heart. It was so funny to me that everyone thought I was dead that as soon as I returned home, I walked to my answering machine and changed the message. Hey, it's Nikki. I'm not home because I'm dead. Then I went into the bathroom, pulled a lump of heroin out of the medicine cabinet, rolled up my sleeve, tied off, and with one sink of the syringe plunger, realized that all the love and concern of those millions of fans still didn't feel as satisfying as one good shot of heroin. I woke up the next afternoon sprawled across the bathroom floor with the needle still dangling out of my arm. The tile floor was covered with blood, my blood. I passed out again. Somewhere, far away, a phone rang. Hey, it's Nikki. I'm not home because I'm dead.
Part 8. Some of our best friends were drug dealers. Chapter 1. Doc McGee. In which a primary caretaker of Motley Crue discusses the finer points of full contact management. My biggest regret as a manager is that I let Vince think he could get away with murder. I remember sitting with Vince after the accident with Razzle, and the lawyers said to him, "The judge wants you to do some time." Vince looked up at them and, I'll never forget these words, said, "I can't." "What do you mean you can't?" I asked him. "I have to go on tour." "Oh, fuck," I slapped my head. "Why didn't I think of using that as your defense? My client, Vince Neil, is innocent of manslaughter and cannot serve time because he has to play some concerts. Case closed." In Vince's mind, he thought he was above the law. And walking away from that disaster with a few weeks in a luxury jail and a $12,000 Rolex certainly didn't teach him otherwise. Now he had every excuse in the world to do what he wanted because nothing could stop him. Guys like Mick, who never said more than 7 words to me in my first 5 years with the band, had eaten shit for so long that they knew what it was like to be nothing. Of course, Mick was a pretty depressed guy after all that, and such a pushover that I always thought he should have his own television show. Do you want to take advantage of me? My real nightmare managing the band began when I tried to keep Vince sober while he was on probation. In Orlando, Florida, on the Theater of Pain tour, we were so sick of his antics that we left him in a hotel room with 2 bodyguards and told them to just beat the shit out of him. The guy's biggest enemy was always himself. On the girls' tour, he was making a sandwich backstage in Rochester and threw a fit when all they had was a jar of Goulden's mustard, not French's mustard. So he slammed the glass bottle against the wall and severed the tendons and several fingers on his right hand. We had to cancel the show and airlift him to a hand specialist in Baltimore. Of course, Vince can't entirely be blamed for his behavior. As his managers, Doug and I condoned it to a certain extent by allowing it to continue, perhaps because the band was so popular. But finally, we had to put our foot down. And what shocked us most is that it wasn't because of Vince. It was because of Nikki. Now, Nikki, the king of the losers, had begun to unravel on the girls' tour. Neither Doug nor I wanted to be around him, so we drew straws to see who would accompany the band to Japan. I drew the short one. Mr. Udo, the promoter there, is one of my best friends. Every time he takes a band to Japan, he puts his reputation on the line for them. And it was no different from Motley Crue, except that Motley Crue couldn't give a fuck. They are savages with cash who care nothing about nobody, even each other. The first thing that happened when we arrived in Japan was that Tommy got caught with pot in his drum kit. Mr. Udo bailed us out of that, and a few days later, we were all leaving Osaka on the bullet train after a show. These clowns were in full costume, with makeup running down their faces and chains and tattoos everywhere. Nikki and Tommy went completely out of control. If you flew above the train in a helicopter, you would have seen all these Japanese people scurrying like cockroaches out of the car we were in. If you zoomed in, you would have seen Nikki throwing a bottle of Jack Daniels and hitting a Japanese businessman in the back of the skull. Lower the microphone, and you would have heard the guy screaming and the blood pumping out of his head. It was just brutal shit. Brutal. When we pulled into the Tokyo station, there were hundreds of policemen running alongside the car. "Hey, Nikki," I said, "your fan club's here." And he was so whacked out that he didn't realize they'd sent the riot squad after him. He thought it was an adoring Japanese public. They hauled Nikki and me to jail. And as we were sitting there, he said to me, "So, dude, how do you like these tattoos? What do you think the cops will think of them?" I thought about my life in Miami. I had a pretty good business going before I moved to the West Coast to manage these guys. I'd played guitar, produced albums by Styx, the Ohio Players, and the Average White Band, managed nice guys like Pat Travers. Life was so peaceful and easy back then. "I don't know," I replied to Nikki, "but I'll tell you this. If they let me get my hands free, I'm going to beat the living shit out of you." Finally, despite Nikki smarting off the whole time, he was released at 5 in the morning. I stayed in the station taking care of paperwork all day, and when I finally returned to my hotel room that night, ready to collapse, who should come banging on the door but Vince. He was smashed and trying to fuck the girlfriend of some Yakuza gangster. But at the same time, his brain-dead L.A. girlfriend had just arrived in Japan and was in his room. So he's pissed off because he doesn't want to deal with the latest mess his dick has gotten him into. "Fire the travel agent," he slobbers. "What? Fire the fucking travel agent." I had taken all I could take that day. I smashed him in the face, closed the door, and sank into a peaceful sleep. That's how it was with those guys. We would punch the shit out of each other all the time. I called it full contact management. When, a few days later, Nikki said he was traveling to Hong Kong, Thailand, and Malaysia with nothing but a pack of rubbers, I considered further violence. I knew I'd have to tag along and babysit, because if I didn't, he'd wind up dead or lost or sold into white slavery. Fortunately, he didn't make it any further than Hong Kong, where he ordered something like 150 prostitutes in 2 days. I could have killed him when he sent a dozen giggling prostitutes to my door while I was on the phone with my family. Of course, Nikki wasn't sexually active then. He probably just talked and talked and talked to the poor hookers until they came to the conclusion that no amount of money was worth this torture. He was a stone-cold junkie, and he was pretty bad off. When we returned to California in December, I started getting calls in the middle of the night from the security company that protected his house because they'd answer alarms only to find him slithering around his yard with a shotgun. A few days before Christmas, I went to dinner with Bob Krasnow of Elektra. "So," he said, "how are the guys doing?" "They'll be okay," I said, "if they can stay alive." Then, just after dinner, Doug called. Nikki had overdosed in some hotel room, and they thought he was dead. I shouldn't have been surprised, but I was. After shock came disgust. Then came disappointment. I was upset with myself for being involved with a band like this and for, in some way, allowing these guys to get away with behaving like animals. Especially now that one animal had killed himself. When I found out that Nikki was actually alive and had escaped from the hospital, I knew what I had to do. I went into the office, called Doug to my desk, and told him, "I'm not doing this. I'm not going to watch people die." They had a European tour scheduled, and there was a better chance of them coming home in body bags than on the Concorde. We canceled the tour and went in search of Nikki. No one answered his phone, but he had changed his answering machine message, so we knew he had been there. We drove to his house and found him knocked out in his bathroom with blood all over the walls. He was lying there in leather pants and no shirt, smacked out and incoherent. I talked him into coming to my house to detox. The problem with Nikki is that, as far as he's concerned, nothing controls him. He controls everything. But in this case, heroin was a much bigger power than he was prepared to reckon with. Nikki stayed at my place in Tarzana for almost a week. Bob Timmons came over every day to try to keep him sober, and Steven Tyler of Aerosmith, who had taken an interest in Nikki, called every day to bully him into straightening up. "You're going to die," he'd tell him. "You've got to see it." Finally, Nikki broke down. He admitted to us for the first time that he couldn't control his addiction. We called in the rest of the band and held a big meeting in my living room. They looked pathetic. There was Nicky, who was dying, Tommy, who was getting loaded and fighting with his wife, Vince, who was completely out of control, and Mick, who basically woke up every morning and drank and sobbed to himself until he passed out. And this was supposed to be one of the biggest, greatest rock bands in the world. Doug and I told them, first, that they were going to pay back the promoters in Europe for their canceled tour out of their own pockets. Second, they were either going to straighten up or find new management. We presented a united front. Nicky admitted that he needed to check into a hospital, something he had never agreed to before. Tommy, who so easily led he'd drink Kool-Aid if Jim Jones asked him to, said he was in, of course. Vince, stubborn and in denial, dragged his heels and waffled, and Mick just gave us a funny look.
Chapter 2. Tommy. Of a fight with a canvas bag, and other matters concerning retribution for adventures too numerous to mention. I was the first one to go. Part of me didn't want to do it, but we were all partying too hard. So we made a pact, and being a team player and shit, I checked into rehab first. I wasn't as bad off as Nicky or Vince, but I was drinking like a maniac, smoking weed, and every once in a while I'd fuck around shooting heroin with Six. That drug was so fucking good it scared me. I didn't think I had any problems, though, until I checked into this place in Tucson called Cottonwood. There was this doctor there who brought all this shit to the surface that I had never even really thought about. On my second day there, he made me sit in a room while he stood behind me. There was nothing else around except for an empty chair across from me. The doctor said that I should look at the empty chair and imagine that my addiction was sitting there. Then he would say things, and I was supposed to imagine that it was my addiction speaking to me. It seemed stupid at first, but after a while I started to believe it. "I know you love me," my addiction said. "You think about me all the time. You can't live without me." Suddenly, all this anger came to the surface, and I jumped up and freaked out. "Wait a minute," I yelled at the empty chair. "Fuck you. I can fucking live without you." "That's good. I want you to talk back to your addiction," the doctor said. "I want you to get mad at it. I want you to destroy it. It is not your friend. It is your enemy." Then he replaced the chair with a heavy canvas sack and handed me a fucking baseball bat. I ran over and started beating the shit out of this fucking addiction sack, dude, and full-blown tears were flying out of my face. "Show it how you feel," the doctor kept egging me on. "It wants to hurt you. Get it out of your life." I kept going crazy on the bag while bawling like a baby. It was like an exorcism, bro. I'll never forget that fucking experience because I realized that there was some other force that had been controlling me for years, and it was the first time I had communicated with it. I didn't know until then how powerful that force was and how powerful it wasn't. Addiction is only as strong as you let it be, and I had let it become too powerful. There was a sign on the wall at Cottonwood that said, "Silence equals death." And I'll never forget that phrase because it made me think of my childhood. My parents were always cool, but whenever I did something wrong, I was punished with silence. They'd send me to my room, and when I asked what I did wrong, they wouldn't speak to me. So I'd sit in my room wondering what the fuck I did and why no one would talk to me. My parents thought that was how they were supposed to teach me a lesson. So from an early age, I equated silence with punishment. When I became older, nothing would piss me off more than someone not talking to me. It still fucking gets to me if a girl doesn't call back or if I do something wrong and get the silent treatment from a friend. Dude, I want to crawl into a hole and die every time. So when I saw that sign in rehab, "Silence equals death," I said to myself, you know what? That's exactly what it fucking felt like as a kid. Everyone in the band was in a different program, but after a week or so, Bob Timmons thought that we should be together as a group, so they all flew down to meet me. We stood in a circle with some other people in the clinic, put our arms around each other, and sang, "You can't always get what you want," which was probably the perfect message for a band like us because we were all so used to getting exactly what we wanted whenever we wanted it. The spigots controlling my eyes turned on again, and I turned to Nicky and sobbed. Isn't this the most beautiful song, dude? And he looked at me like I was crazy, then looked at Mick and whispered something about me falling for this Jim Jones shit. I don't think anyone in the band ever took me seriously. I was seen as the puppy dog whose paws were too big and always tripped over everything. But then, after singing, we all sat down. The counselor asked us to visualize ourselves as little boys, and all of a sudden, Nicky broke down. His face turned red, and he was so choked up he couldn't speak a word. Later, he said that he visualized himself at one end of a street with his mother at the other end, and he realized that all his unresolved bitterness and resentment toward his mother and father were still haunting him. If I was the goofball that they were learning had a genuine sadness behind the mask, Nicky was the madly charging ram who we learned had a tender spot, where real feelings and emotions lay. Even Vince, the most impenetrable of us all, began to open up and cry. For the first time, I saw a weakness in Motley Crue that I had never noticed before. We all turned into broken-down little children, except for Mick, who was being strangely stubborn and refused to open up. Every time we sang together or meditated or went through any exercise to get in touch with our emotions, I'd look at him, and he'd have an expression on his face like he was about to vomit all over the floor.
Chapter 3 Mick, in which Mick succeeds in affronting the multitudinous members of temperance leagues, cults, and costly rooming houses. It was as simple as this. I saw how ugly and bloated I looked. I saw how close Nicky had come to dying. And I saw how our managers were so sick of us they were going to quit. In fact, I was so sick of us that I was ready to quit if something didn't change. So I cut out the drinking. You can only stop when you want to stop. And I was ready to stop. I didn't like the feeling of being vulnerable when I was drunk because in that state it's easy for people to take advantage of you. And I was badly damaging my bones because I was getting so rotted I'd make a reckless move and wake up the next morning in crippling pain, which I'd anesthetize with more liquor until I was so drunk I'd do something stupid again. Sober, I lost 20 pounds and 100 wrinkles within a few weeks. Whenever I craved a drink or felt frustrated, I'd just curl my fingers into a circle, as if I were holding a shot glass, yell, boom, and snap my hand toward my mouth, as if I was hammering a shot of tequila. That was my boom, my therapy. I think it scared a lot of people, but it made me happy. It was also a lot cheaper than rehab. Nicky, Tommy, and Vince, in the meantime, checked in and out of rehab so many times I could never keep track of who was where. Nicky thinks rehab did the band a lot of good, but I don't believe it. I would visit them in rehab and see therapists tearing those guys apart until they felt like zeros. They'd get humiliated and degraded and stuck in rooms with people who had real problems, people who had been raped by their fathers.